Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and Merry Christmas to everybody. I suppose everyone's been out feasting and celebrating the holiday with their families, and I could safely say that probably almost no one would be listening tonight, so we can say anything we want. Right, Mike? No, we certainly won't do that, but Mike, you do need to leave me alone about this chair. Ladies and gentlemen, I decided to buy a new chair for my desk in the office, and Mike will just not leave me alone. What do you call it, Mike? You call it a king's chair? Okay, a king's chair. It's not as big as a king's chair, but I will point out something I'm proud of. It is made in America. How about that? I looked and looked, and I found a very comfortable chair made in the United States, and that's what I'm sending in tonight. So I know it's going to be missing the characteristic squeak, but you'll have to do without that. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny Cash, as always, for that marvelous trip he takes across the United States when he sings that song, I've Been Everywhere, Man. By the way, Mike, I did hear today on XM Radio, XM Sirius, Channel 13, Willie's Place, I heard that David Byrne song, I've Been Everywhere, with the Texas version, starting with Amarillo. So I was very surprised to hear that on XM Radio. I didn't know the song had gotten that far. That's the one we played, I think, a couple of weeks ago, where he travels across Texas on his BMW motorcycle. That was sent to us by Sheriff Rodenberg in the state of Ohio. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is to discuss news, events, issues, and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. I guess tonight's subject isn't very humorous, although there are death penalty jokes, but we're going to take part two tonight of our look at the death penalty. We've really not done that in almost 3 years. And again, I'm recommending a very good book, writing partner of mine with our Introduction to Criminal Justice book, Dr. Bob Bohm. If you haven't read Death Quest 2, then you're missing one of the quintessential works on the state of the death penalty in the United States, and a marvelous historical section also. So anyway, our show is dedicated to those police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice and private security. We forget to mention them most of the time, but I include them as part of the criminal justice system, simply private contractors who help protect people, property, information, perimeters, and all sorts of other things in the United States, too. So we include them in our comment of gratitude. We try to look inside the criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals, and once or twice somebody actually called us the NPR of criminal justice, and I thought maybe that was a stretch, but we'll accept it when we need the when we need the compliment. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and I was telling some people about this this past week, and they didn't believe it. They were actually talking about radio and a radio show, and I said, look, have you thought about BTR, which allows you what? Any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. I'm not even going to go over it again tonight, but think about what that means if you happen to have never heard it before. It's an incredible opportunity for any person, group, organization that wants to do something like that, and it doesn't cost a penny. And as we said before, BTR is now on the top 100 websites in the world, and all sorts of people have shows on there. And you need to take a look at all those other shows that are on there. You'll find celebrities, commentators, politicians, et cetera, with their own radio shows. Very, very interesting. And these shows are archived, by the way, immediately for replay on MP3 download format within about probably, I'd say immediately, but it's 5 to 10 minutes after the show is over. So get your own shows, what I'm fond of saying. As I said tonight, we're going to do the death penalty part two, and it's a topic that will never be rid of in the United States. Even if we ended up eliminating the death penalty entirely, there are those who will continue to advocate it, and for the right reasons. I understand the arguments clearly for and against the death penalty and what the issues are involved, and we covered those last week, and you could probably put all those in a list and say there's I've narrowed it down to maybe 14 different points of issue about the death penalty where there's a pro and con position. They're not mutually exclusive entirely, but listen to last week's show if you want to hear those arguments. But what we're going to do tonight, we're going to hear the second part, really the last third, so to speak, of the Cato Institute discussion on the death penalty with four very astute commentators in the field, and I think one of the most interesting and entertaining that you hear tonight is Judge Kaczynski, Alex Kaczynski from the United States Court of Appeals, and he's going to be talking about the death penalty. Then what we hear at the end is a discussion of all four of the panelists and the moderator talking about the issues relative to the death penalty. So I think you'll enjoy that. That tonight. We've got some crazy criminal justice news here to start out with. Where was that, Emily? You found that news article about the guy, the gang member. He looked 25 years old to me, but he goes and sits on Santa Claus's lap, and while he's sitting on Santa Claus's lap, and he's got his tattoos and all the other things that you might imagine gang members to have, and he starts flashing gang signs and has people taking pictures of him. Well, it turns out the police, that violates his probation status because that means he's affiliating or doing gang things or something. So the police came out to visit him as a result of that. Let's take a look at some of these other news stories. They're interesting, too. Let me see if you can find that one or I'm looking at here. Where did that go? Oh, there it is. This is an interesting one. Those of you folks who like CSI shows, and what is there, CSI Miami, CSI, who knows, New York, CSI Mars? No, we don't have that show yet, but it's probably coming. But this is a good one. This takes place in Finland, and this time of year in Finland, they have a lot of time to investigate crime because it's pretty dark, it gets pretty cold, and Finland is 70% forested, if you don't know much about Finland, a very interesting place, a beautiful country to visit. I'd like to do that myself sometimes, but here we have a case where the police have caught a car thief in Finland. By doing what? They noticed a mosquito that looked pretty full when they recovered a stolen car. Looked fatter than usual, I guess, is what they're referring to. And they took the mosquito and did a little operation, took a sample of the blood, and got the DNA of this particular person, and they ran that in their database, and it linked up with somebody that was already in their database, and he is their car thief. The car thief has at least admitted to the fact that he got a ride in that car, his defense attorney says, but he didn't steal it. In other words, the owner gave him a ride. So I think that's not going to, excuse the pun, fly very well. That's interesting that the Finnish police would have time or even think of looking at mosquitoes. So there's a whole new thing maybe. I've never heard of that before here in the United States. So maybe we can see more mosquito analysis, and students will be interested in majoring in forensics more as a result of that. Let me take a look at this other news story. Another news story here that's another Christmas story. We always have two or three or four major Christmas stories. Here's one that's not so major, but it's interesting. In Tempe, Arizona, what's happened is that these Santa Claus people are dressing up in costumes, and what they're doing is they're going out and covering up the web cameras. Isn't that interesting? They're going out and putting covers, and they actually have videos of them doing that, in Santa Claus suits, going out and covering up the traffic camera, excuse me. Says here, a group of Santa lookalikes cheerfully covered red light cameras around the city here recently. This very generous gift was captured on film, purportedly by someone who was in the group themselves. The video description lends us to believe this group may have a beef with the authorities. Yes, I would probably say that. Says here, only Santa knows who's naughty and nice, not Redflex, DPS, or the Border Patrol. So anyway, you know, when you got nothing else to do, I guess you dress up in a Santa suit and go out and cover up traffic and red speeding and red light cameras is what they actually covered. I think that's a little odd also, isn't it? There's another Christmas story about shoplifting. Apparently it's up 10% this year, at least in December. And I haven't looked at the data, but I suspect it probably goes up every December. And they were saying in this article that one out of 11 people actually shoplift. That's interesting to see if that's true. I don't know if that's truth by survey or what other method they use to determine that. But one out of 11 people, that sounds like a lot, doesn't it? They have a story here in the New York Times of this poor guy went to buy some sleep medicine. He was $1 short, so he decided to steal it, and he actually got caught. And they're saying that the tough economic times have promoted shoplifting. I guess, and it's funny, the things they're stealing are like electronics, and it's not like they're stealing a lot of food, although that has happened. But I guess, you know, I can't get my next Wii product, so you know, maybe I'll go out and steal it because I don't have enough money. I don't know if that flies very far in terms of a justification for a crime, but we see that happening all over the place in the United States. Shoplifting's up, and security and shoplifting is probably up too in terms of more and more surveillance cameras and that type of thing. Here's an interesting story about surveillance cameras, and what's happening is this one place in Scotland, a judge is now, or what they're doing is they're actually monitoring hand washing. They want spy cameras to watch over this one hospital because they think the employees, according to Dr. Richard Simpson, have not been following the instructions that they need to wash their hands. So what they're doing is installing cameras in the lavatories or wherever they wash their hands, to see what type of compliance they're actually getting with hand washing. And it's 22 of the 42 wards were actually audited by these surveillance cameras, and it looks like the sole purpose of this is to make sure that employees actually wash their hands. So who knows what's next with audio and visual and the combination types of surveillance. You're going to be seeing it more and more, and we've mentioned that some of these companies that actually push the red light cameras or sell those, they're actually letting folks know that we also at those intersections can do 360-degree audio monitoring. So be careful what you say at the stoplight. It may, in fact, be picked up by the police. This is a story that relates to tonight. New Hampshire, and if there was ever a place for the death penalty, this sounds like a good one. A judge issued the state's first death sentence in the state of New Hampshire in nearly 50 years to a man who shot and killed a Manchester police officer in 2006. The death sentence for this man, his name is Michael Addison, that's mandatory under state law, and it was ordered last Thursday by a Hillsborough County Superior Court jury. The police have been looking for Mr. Addison, and he was a former Boston gang member, oh boy, with a long criminal record, and another man in connection with a week-long crime spree where Officer Michael Briggs, 35, and his bicycle partner came across two men in an alley. They recognized the men as suspects and ordered them to stop. Mr. Addison then turned and shot Officer Briggs in the head at close range, according to testimony. State Supreme Court reviewed the conviction, and the sentence is automatic. And soon New Hampshire, who knows when he'll be executed, but if there's ever a case where it's appropriate, that sounds like a pretty good case. I have to look at the law exactly, see what they mean by mandatory. I don't know if it's mandatory for shooting a police officer as a special category or just in the nature of the crime itself. But that's interesting. Well, this is a Christmas story, too, I guess. At least it was done during the holidays. The Cook County Sheriff, he had people fill out a survey. And then he went to some place where there apparently there were lots of crooks where he made the survey available. And he said the promise of easy money apparently proved too tempting for some of these fugitives over the weekend. With an exclamation that they were positively no gimmicks, investigators sent letters from a fictitious company called Shoptastic Solutions to people with outstanding warrants. He offered them $500. Yeah, this has been done before. For filling out a marketing survey, according to the Chicago Trib, more than 60 fugitives showed up to get their to get their coupon, and they were in fact arrested. All sorts of ploys that the police do, not only in holiday times but throughout the year and things like that. I like these. Like I said, if you took average IQ in the penitentiary, it's probably not going to, you know, bust any norms there. So anyway, that's an interesting thing they're doing. Shoplifting's up. I'll mention one more thing about electronic books. You know, from listening to me in the past, I really enjoy those, and I have my Sony Reader, and it looks like they're taking over. Not taking over, but they're on the move. New York Times article says, turning the page, e-books start to take hold. And Amazon Kindle has really done this. Kindle won't, or Amazon won't release how many they've sold, but it's a bunch, and I just looked yesterday to see how they were doing, and they're sold out. And I think a year ago it was the same thing after Christmas time, so we hear that a new version is going to be coming out soon. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but it will be, I've heard, an 8.5 and 11 version, and perhaps even a little bit thinner. So that'll be interesting. The college book bag and the pack and carrying around 5 or 6 heavy textbooks may be gone, and our introduction to criminal justice book is in e-book form now. So, you know, it makes sense to me, and some of these have audio reading, and there's a lot to this. It's a long story, but it looks like the electronic book has actually arrived. And those of you who don't have one, have never experimented with one, you should realize that this thing is readable in the brightest sunlight you can find. It's like paper. It's not like a computer screen or a cell phone screen. So they seem to be here. They're not cheap initially, but, you know, $300 or $400 is what it takes. And Sony's actually come out with another one. Oops, don't tell me that. It's a $400 device with a reading light and a touch screen that allows you to annotate the screen. Well, anyway, That's the story about the CJ News. And, Audrey, I think you have am I mistaken? You have another joke tonight about the season, don't you? If anybody chooses to call in here in the next minute or so before we start working on some of this content, you can call in at 347-996-5983. 347-996-5983. But Audrey, I think you have a seasonal type of joke, and it's going to be tough to beat last week's. Do folks remember that one? With the five blonde guys. I love that joke, and so far that's my favorite. Look that up, folks, if you hadn't heard it last week. Go ahead and play the show. But Audrey, go ahead with this one. Let's see what you've got.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke tonight is appropriate for Christmas, and I do hope no one will take offense at it. I want to say for Mike, Emily, and me, Merry Christmas to all, and may all your Christmases be bright. Okay, here is the joke. A dumb blonde died and went to heaven. When she got to the pearly gates, she met St. Peter, who said, "Before you get to come into heaven, you have to pass a test." "Oh, no," she said, but St. Peter said not to worry, he'd make it easy. "Who was God's son?" said St. Peter. The dumb blonde thought for a few minutes and said, "Andy." "That's interesting. What made you say that?" said St. Peter. Then she started to sing, "Andy walks with me. Andy talks with me. Andy tells me." "That is enough," said St. Peter.
"Andy walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tries to tell me," or something, words to that effect. But thank you very much for that one. I don't think any folks will be taking offense of that. And certainly during the holiday time, we want to be sure to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms public service announcement to the criminals on the street and the admonition to them that they should turn in their firearms. So go ahead, Ohio Coalition. Here we are.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It certainly is. And thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. I hope that message falls upon the right ears, and they do what they're supposed to do. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to go back to that Cato Institute thorough discussion. If you choose to hear the whole thing, it's not very long, but it's an hour and 37 minutes. That's at the Cato Institute on the Internet, and I think that's catoinstitute.org, if I'm not mistaken. Let me see here what that is. Yeah, cato.org, right. And it's a very thorough discussion, and it involves four people, Judge Alex Kaczynski, Harvey Silverslate, David Frum, a commentator, you've seen him before, I'm sure, but in lawyer background, I believe, and Jarrett Parker, and the combined experience of these gentlemen in legal defense and scholarly law work and publishing is just incredible. But what we're going to try to do tonight is start with they've each kind of presented their case, other than Mr. Kaczynski, and he's the judge. And Alex Kaczynski is going to start off tonight talking about his particular views on the death penalty. And I like what he has to say, because he has some analogies that make us think. So Mike, go ahead and turn us on to this. Ladies and gentlemen, it might take a few seconds to make the transition here, but here we go. This is Judge Alex Kaczynski talking about the death penalty.
Where the public is learning, the less support there is for the death penalty.
He'll be up in just a second.
No surprise to me, and I hope to say that Niall is the first position about 2 or 3 years from now, and I believe we will be. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Judge Alex Kaczynski. Judge Kaczynski serves on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in Pasadena, California. And in that capacity, he must often consider the legal appeals that come from death row prisoners. I can only give you the highlights of Judge Kaczynski's remarkable career, because we simply do not have the time to mention all of his educational and professional achievements. He graduated first in his class from the UCLA Law School. He then clerked for Anthony Kennedy, who was then serving as a federal appellate judge in California. After that clerkship, he went to the Supreme Court and clerked for the Chief Justice, Warren Burger. Judge Kaczynski then joined the Reagan administration, and he served in several posts before he was appointed the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Claims. At age 35, President Reagan nominated him for the U.S. Court of Appeals, and he was the youngest person to assume a federal appellate judgeship in over 100 years. Judge Kaczynski has now been on the Court of Appeals for 15 years, and it's no overstatement to say that he's one of the most influential judges in our country, not because of his political connections, but because of his powerfully reasoned opinions. He's frequently on the road speaking at law schools and before lawyers' groups, and somehow he finds time to publish book reviews, op-eds, and scholarly law review articles. We're very fortunate that he decided to stop here and give us his thoughts on the death penalty. Please welcome Judge Alex Kaczynski.
Thank you. Good afternoon. You know, it's turned out to be less of a debate than I thought there would be. It seems to me we're mostly in fundamental agreement on the issues. David Frum, for example, said, listen to the arguments and see whether you can apply them to against the death penalty and see if they apply to anything else, any other kind, kinds that call for imprisonment, kinds that call for a fine, maybe jaywalking. And sure enough, Mr. Silvergate gets up here and he tells us that not only is every person on death row probably innocent, but Jeffrey McDonald's innocent, and Mike Milton's innocent. I was waiting to hear that maybe Lee Harvey Oswald was just walking by in Dallas that day, and, you know, we don't know. The fact of the matter is we have a criminal justice system that has built within it certain procedural safeguards. It is weighted heavily against prosecution. There cannot be a conviction unless there's guilt beyond reasonable doubt, proof to a jury that must unanimously agree to convict. If you want to have a death sentence in addition to that, you have to take further steps, and the Supreme Court laid out what the steps were over the years since Furman, since 1972. And there has to be yet another determination, either by a judge or by a jury, having to do with the heinousness of the offense, that the defendant must be given a chance to show he's a good guy after all, that yes, he may have strangled and maimed and killed three or four defendants, but you know, it's because he was abused as a child, or because you know, he had a heart of gold. These are not mock trials, contrary to what you've been led to hear. They are real trials in with real witnesses. In a death case, the prosecution or the defense is given, in most states, not only the normal resources, but also additional resources. In California, where I'm from, a vast additional resources. You don't get one lawyer, you get two. You get a psychologist. You get an investigator. You get almost unlimited funds to conduct defense, and so on. And by the end of the day, it is a rare case where somebody gets convicted and has not gotten a good dose of due process, more than due process than in most criminal cases. Now, there are 3,700 people on death row. Since 1973, we have actually put closer to 6,000 people on death row. We've executed, I forget what the running number is, but I think it's something like 300 people since then. And we have removed from death row because of errors, because of some problem with the death penalty or the conviction, something on the order of 2,000 people. So the turnover is fairly high. So even after somebody gets to the point where they are, they get their two lawyers, they get their psychologist, they get their investigator, they have a double determination by the jury judge about guilt and eligibility for the death, a process kicks in, the likes of which is never seen in the history of due process. Anywhere in the world, where court after court at the appellate level, on the state level, and then on federal review on habeas, will look and sift through the evidence and carefully consider a variety of issues and make the determination that, in fact, there are no constitutional errors that had a bearing on the outcome of the case. Now, is this process perfect, or do we have to defend this process as being perfect? I don't think so. I think we have to realize that any enterprise run by man, any enterprise not run through divine intervention, will have an error rate. You get on a plane to get here or to leave, and you know that a statistical matter, some plane will go down in the world in the next 12 months. It may be the plane that you are getting on, despite the best efforts that are already involved. Few people say, look, I won't get on a plane because of the risk. But most of us do it because we realize if we want to get from here to there, getting on a plane is the least dangerous way to get there. And the alternative of getting there by car exposes us to much greater risk. All we could live our lives by not getting there. And that's an alternative we don't want to take. Criminal law is just like running a nuclear reactor. It is just like running a railroad, just like running an airplane. We do our best, and we really do our best, to make sure we separate the guilty from the innocent, but we have to come to grips with risk that once in a while, and hopefully once in a very, very long while, somebody who is innocent is punished. But that's not a risk that's unique in death cases. We have 2 million people in prison, and I'm willing to bet, this is a statistical matter, that some of them are there and totally innocent, and it breaks my heart to say it. It's possible that some people who are on death row wind up being innocent, or some people possibly, conceivably, who have been executed as innocent. Although it's remarkable that no one has found any evidence, despite testing post-execution, sometimes testing right before execution, has found a case where this has been proven. Now, this uncertainty that we have, should this paralyze us, because my God, it could be that we are one day going to execute a innocent person, should that paralyze us, does that make the enterprise not worthwhile? And it seems to me what you have to do is ask yourself, what is it that the death penalty gives us? And are those things legitimate? And are those things worth the cost? And let me tell you about the run-of-the-mill death case. This is not the death case where the evidence is flimsy or there were jailhouse informants or the like, which it does come up, and we have to deal with them, and usually the death sentence gets set aside in those cases. Deal with somebody like John Wayne Gacy. And let's talk about him because, you know, he's sort of a poster boy. There were not, not in my court, not in my circuit, so I know what I know about John Wayne Gacy from the newspaper accounts, but there were no serious suppression issues in this case. There were no serious issues of police obtaining evidence improperly. There was a young boy missing. The police somehow saw that he had talked to Gacy. They went to talk to him. He acted suspicious. They watched take out his house, eventually got a warrant, which as far as I know has never been challenged, and they dug under the house, and they pulled out a horrible cache of dead bodies. Young men in their teens, in their late teens, in their early 20s, who had been taken home by Mr. Gacy, who had been tricked into being tied down somehow, and then sexually abused, burned, and garroted over a period of days. And then what he did is he buried the bodies in his basement. Now, I don't know. I suppose there's some way in which those bodies got under Mr. Gacy's basement, other than him putting it there. Although when the police got to the house was overwhelmed with a smell of death. Mr. Gacy didn't come and say, my God, somebody stuck dead bodies in my basement. So I'm reasonably confident, as sure as I am about anything, as sure as I am on the fact that I'm standing here, that the way those bodies got into that basement is investigated, put them there. There are other cases, the case of Barnum, the fellow that strangled and sodomized the cigarette young boys in Los Angeles. And the way we know that it was really him is that he got in the courtroom and he would see the parents of the victims and he'd say, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I remember you little boy. And he cried in pain for his mother. He cried for you and you weren't there. He said that in the old letters to the parents in the same vein. I don't think, I suppose it could be a joke on his part or maybe an accident. But I don't think so. I don't think we have spent much time worrying whether we got the wrong guy in Mr. Barnum's case. There's a long, long list of people just like that, and most of the people we execute are like that. Cases where there is no doubt, not a reasonable doubt, not a shadow of a doubt, no doubt. The kind of certainty you have that you have when you walk across that jetway. The certainty you have, I am going to get out on the other side. That's the kind of certainty you can have about some of these people, most of the people who are executed. So the question is, given that we do have such cases, and all our opponents here have said, well, they're not all like that, I said, okay, let's put all the other cases aside. Let's put the cases about which some reason people have to outside. And what do we do with these guys, these monsters? People who kill and kill again and confess, and there's no doubt of their guilt, who have no remorse, who take the opportunity of the trial to inflict further damage on the victims, the living victims, the surviving victims, by gloating. Barnum used to got a transcript of his testimony, because he's entitled to a transcript, and what he would do is he would take the pieces of the testimony where the expert explained the unspeakable things that he did to the little boys before he finally put them to death, the way he tortured them, the way he sodomized them, the way he made them squeal and cry. And he would autograph them and sell them by mail. They became collector's items. He actually made money. There's a service out there on the internet that sells astronomophilia. What do we do with somebody like that? And I would tell you, I would rely on John Stuart Mill and Kant, very different philosophers, but both express the view that to take the life of a man who has taken that of another is not to show want of regard for human life. On the contrary, it shows most emphatically our regard for it by the adoption of the rule that he who violates that right in another forfeits it for himself, and while no other crime that he can commit deprives him of his right, this shall. We are a moral society, and we have respect for human life. For human life is to us sacred, and it strikes me that a moral society to whom life is sacred cannot simply treat the taking, the malicious taking of human life as just another criminal event. We have a moral responsibility to show the kind of indignation, the kind of moral outrage that says, yeah, this is difficult for us, this may be painful for us, but we will, in fact, insist on the ultimate punishment. There is the problem of, we talked about deterrence. We don't know much about deterrence. We don't know whether any of our criminal laws deter anything in particular. But we know one thing for sure. No one who has been executed has ever come back and done it again. While there are lots and lots and lots of people today who are dead because people who got convicted of one crime, and I can give you case after case, and I haven't, I don't have time to list them all, where people got the death penalty for a set of crimes, got the sentence commuted, walked out, and killed somebody else. You want to talk about the risk? You want to talk about the risk of error, you have to include the risk that somebody else will fall for it. This person will die if you do not, in fact, make sure that this monster stays in jail or has no possibility of leaving. And finally, I would call out, I think is very important, is the effect on the lives of the victims, the surviving victims. I saw a program on A&E recently about Spacey, the guy in Chicago who killed the Speck. He profited from the Truman decision, so he did not get the death penalty. He spent, until very recently when he died, he spent time in prison. His death sentence was commuted to life because of the Truman decision. And every year, his family, the family of those nurses, had to relive the event. Because every year he tried to get parole, and they would travel, and they'd come before the parole board, and they would have to relive the horror of the event by telling their story and pleading to keep this man in prison. Fact of the matter is, they don't stay in prison. You say you give somebody a life sentence, they stay in prison. No, they want out. They will file federal petitions. They will file pleas for clemency. They will try to bring evidence that they are innocent or whatever. And the families have to live with a possibility, with a risk, with a sort of open soul having the murderer of the children, the murderer of their loved ones, being there alive, breathing, and trying to get out. Many families tell us, not all, but many families tell us that they have a sense of relief. They have a sense of closure. They have a sense of finality when the perpetrator is executed. It is immoral for us as a society to deny that sense of succor, that little sense of relief to these people who are rendering those who have it in such a way. And it is cowardly for us not to have the courage to do what is necessary to give these good people an additional, a small measure of fact.
We are now going to allow the panelists to question one another. We're going to go back to Jerry Decker. He's going to pose a question to one of the gentlemen on the other side, and that gentleman will have a few minutes to answer.
Well, Mr. Frum engaged me a little bit in his speech, so I would like to return the favor. David, we've had about, by last count, I think I saw about 87 people exonerated due to DNA evidence. A number of those people were on death row. A number of those people came extremely close to execution. A number of those people came within days of execution and were not executed, not because of the DNA evidence, but because of some fortuity. A judge requests a review of whether the defendant is so retarded that he should not be executed or some other event unrelated to the evidence itself. When you look at those cases of exoneration, and as I've mentioned, eventually we're not going to have this window into the system. We're not going to have this peek at how things may work in cases as a whole, because DNA will become a regularized part of our criminal process. That will cause great improvements. We'll catch more guilty people, but we won't have this glimpse of how justice works in cases where there's how the evidence, how reliable our evidence is, how reliable our cases are. What do you think that these DNA exonerations tell us about other kinds of cases where the same quality of evidence, the same eyewitness testimony, the same source of evidence that were disproved by DNA in these cases was used to obtain a conviction, and those people are still in prison or still on death row?
I think what these cases tell us is the extreme care and scrupulosity of the American system of justice. If I understand your question is this, here are some cases where there is evidence that tends to suggest that the person who was convicted was in fact innocent after all, and he was then let go. Doesn't that make me worry about the many people about whom there's no evidence of innocence at all? What about them? Don't people without evidence of their innocence also have a right to escape prison? And my reaction to that is, you know, when a person, when there's a lot of evidence that someone is guilty and no evidence that he's innocent, my conclusion is, you know, he's probably guilty. And that the this window that you described, this is proof of the system looks for all the evidence of an innocence that it can. If there is evidence, it will be found. It will be found partly through the conscientious work of good lawyers like yourself. It will be found through the many, many people who have devoted their lives to throwing sand into the gears of American justice to stop death penalty cases. It will be found. And if it's not found, maybe that implies that it's not there, and that what we have here is one of the people who's responsible for the 500,000 murders that occur instead of occurring in the United States over the past quarter century.
Okay, David, you spoke second, so it's your turn to pose a question.
My question is this. I'd like the name of a man whom you are yourself sure is innocent. You yourself are sure is innocent, who has in fact been executed since 1977.
I'll respond first by saying I think that if you take a look at the May 14, 2000 issue of the New York Times, read the case that I described as being deeper, a reasonable person reading that can really come to no other conclusion than that man is innocent. The second thing I would point out is that in the case of Joseph O'Dell in Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia is vigorously fighting turning over the DNA evidence that would establish whether this executed inmate was in fact innocent. They're fighting it tooth and nail, and in fact they want to destroy the evidence. Ordinarily, if you're trying to get DNA evidence tested on behalf of a live inmate, there are certain arguments you can try to make, that you have constitutional right for it. You can try to bring an action under what's called Section 1983 to say that if this evidence is not turned over, it will be a due process violation. Or if you're still at a stage where you have rights to make arguments in court, and often those are lost through procedural bars, through time bars, through you've got one shot and you can't come back rules that are becoming more and more prevalent, often even on behalf of a live defendant, you cannot get that DNA tested. On behalf of a dead defendant, there is no ordinary process, there is no ordinary motion that you can make to try to get that evidence tested. And in the case of Joseph O'Dell in Virginia, who died, was put to death, maintaining his innocence on very sketchy evidence, the Commonwealth of Virginia wants to make sure that you don't know whether he was guilty or not. Why would they do that? What possible excuse is there for wanting to destroy the evidence that would establish whether he was guilty or not? I would point out to you that if you look at any other government agency, what they want to do with that DNA, what Virginia is trying to do with that DNA, and what they're trying to do is destroy it. They want to destroy it, and right now, because there's judicial process going on, they haven't destroyed it. What would you think of any other government agency that was challenged on some conduct that it engaged in and wanted to destroy the evidence before anyone had a chance to review it? What would you say about that government agency? But that's what the Commonwealth of Virginia is doing, and that's what's going on all over the country. So when death penalty proponents say to me, prove it, of course, they have a two-pronged answer for everything, don't they? The first prong is any case where there is not DNA evidence. So going to the area of evidence that just almost everyone agrees is just dispositive. It just proves what it purports to prove. If you don't have DNA evidence, then we're not impressed. For example, James Beathard, no DNA evidence there. It's just the prosecutor put on two directly contradictory stories, got the death penalty. Okay, that's not good enough. If there might be DNA evidence available, they put every roadblock in your way. They try to prevent you from having that DNA sample. Why do you think they do that? It's because they can't afford to ship. They can't afford for the public to see what that DNA evidence may show, because they can't run their death penalty system if people know that they're executing innocent people.
Actually, there has been a development in the Odell case. The efforts to test the DNA in that case weren't successful. Officials burned all of the evidence in that case two months ago and foreclosing the possibility of any future tests done on the evidence in the case. Harvey, it's your turn to pose a question.
I was interested, I posed this to Judge Kaczynski. I was interested in hearing the judge say that the executed don't kill again, and that to allow a convicted murderer, whom we're sure, reasonably sure, did it, is to risk the error of further taking of innocent life. Judge Kaczynski also conceded that the death penalty system, the judicial system, and I assume Judge Kaczynski would include the executive branch that investigates these crimes, is not perfect, just like any human institution is not perfect. I assume that that is a at least an implied concession that there might have been mistakes, even if David Frum wouldn't accept the names that my colleague and I might mention. Now, my question is this. Assuming that there is an inevitable risk of error in any human institution, is there a difference, a moral difference, since the judge spoke in terms of morality, is there a moral difference between the state taking a life in error and a released murderer taking a life again?
Well, of course there's a difference. If the state takes a life in error, it has done its best to avoid it, and I see no moral culpability there. Just like there's no moral culpability to put a plane in the air that later turns out to have a defective part and then kills 150 people or 300 people. It's unfortunate, it's sad, but it is not a moral failing. Whereas if you let somebody out of prison and that person kills another human being, that's a deliberate killing. That's an unlawful deliberate killing, and that is highly immoral. And I believe we become, as a society, parties to that immorality when we allow that to happen. We don't have to guess about these people. Think about Mr. Coker. 1977 Supreme Court case, Coker versus Georgia. Coker was in prison, I believe, in Georgia, but, you know, one of those states. And he was serving three life sentences. And the reason he was serving three life sentences because his death sentences got commuted to life. There was a prison break. He escaped. Not far from the prison, he found the house of this family, a husband, a wife, a six-week-old baby. Proceeded to tie up the husband and rape the wife in front of the husband. And then fortunately, he actually let them go. There wasn't a murder. And the case came to the Supreme Court on the question of whether he could suffer the death penalty. The Supreme Court said no. You only get the death penalty for taking another life. But what Coker demonstrates is that people do steal sparrow. So long as you're alive, you have hope. So long as you're in prison, you come in contact with other human beings. You can sodomize, you can beat, you can attack other prisoners, you can kill guards. Escape and kill people during escape. After escape, you can kill, maim, rape, and create all sorts of havoc on other people. There's a chance somebody will let you out of prison and do it again. There are lots of instances, real human beings who have done all these things. And there are real dead human beings, innocent parties, who were walking along, minding their business, and I'm dead today for no reason other than they had the misfortune of running one of these lowlifes who somehow made his way out of prison, even though having committed a murder, but somehow to escape through guiles or something else, was allowed to get out and take another life of life. And I think when we allow that, we become complicit. We become complicit because we did not have the moral fortitude to do what's necessary to protect innocent members of our society. But let me ask you a question, Mr. Silvergate. Yeah. I have a phone here, okay, and it is on the other side of the line. it's the kind of phone that goes not only over distance but over time. But on this scaffold is a man with a noose around his neck. His name is Eichmann. It's Jerusalem. It's 1962. And you are the president of Israel. And the line is open. And unless you give the word to commute his sentence, in 15 seconds, the cab door will open. I hand you the phone. What do you think? I would stop the execution because as an executive, as the president of Israel, I'm given the authority to do that, and I would exercise the authority, and I can explain exactly why. And that's because, as I said, I have personal moral scruples about the death penalty, and if I were running the president of Israel, presumably I would have the good character during the course of the election to let people know that they would take me or leave me, knowing what my views are. Having taken me and elected me to the presidency, I would have no qualms in exercising my personal moral judgment, my executive authority to commute the sentence. Why would I commute the sentence of a monster like Eichmann? Because I believe personally, and this is not, I don't expect anybody here, I'm not proselytizing my moral view, but I was asked about it. I believe that the state should not be in the business of killing people except defensively in war.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is probably the most, Mr. Silverslate's comment there is probably the most common argument against the death penalty that you hear in Europe, or at least in some European states, that the state shouldn't be executing its own citizens. And by the way, that story about the people that get off death row, there are better stories than came up there than the one that the judge mentioned in Mark Stallo in my book called Crime and Punishment in the Lone Star State. We have a story in there about Kenneth McDuff, who actually got off a death row twice, the first time in the 1970s because of the Furman decision, and then later on he gets off another time, and he goes out and kills again, kidnapped a convenience store clerk in Waco, Texas, and murdered her. So there are other examples of that. You notice they're a little wobbly on coming up with the names of people who've been wrongfully executed since 1977. The Furman decision was 1972. The Gregg decision was 1976. Essentially, Furman stopped the executions until states got their law straightened out. In 1976, the execution started again, and it bifurcated the process. You have a guilt and innocence hearing, then you have a sentencing hearing where you have to consider aggravated and mitigating circumstances before the death penalty can be assigned to a person. But since 77, those who say that there have been some that have been executed wrongfully aren't holding the proof bar very high. They're hanging around down somewhere between a hunch and suspicion is the way I look at it from the PA. You could talk about the subject literally forever. And if you want some good data on it, it's an anti-death penalty site, but it's good data and more power to them for providing us this data. It's the Death Penalty Information Center, and you can find that at deathpenaltyinfo.org. That's deathpenaltyinfo.org, and it's an excellent site. And it talks about a lot of different things. It portrays there that we have 36 states with the death penalty, and number of executions total since 1977 have been 1,136. So this presentation we did with the Cato Institute had good arguments, but it's a little dated, and I don't think they actually knew, at least the commentators didn't know the numbers, at least on the tip of their tongues. 57% of those have been executed have been white, and 34% have been black. And there's always the argument about is the death penalty racially biased, and it's a very complicated issue. And as much as I've looked at it, it looks to me like we execute as we lock up people we fear, and we fear stranger homicide, and those who commit stranger homicide are the ones more likely to be executed. And just on the base of robberies and other kinds of things, well, you know the deplorable state of the murder rate among young black males, and it's five, six times higher than it is for others. But stranger homicide, and they don't I actually get executed. It's the stranger homicide, and that sometimes, or at least fairly regularly involves a cross-racial type of confrontation. So very complicated subject, and I hope you enjoyed the show. And we're going to come back to this perhaps at another time, and we'll be seeing you again. It'll be a new year, and thank you for joining in this year, all of you who are regular listeners, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope you have too. We'll have new guests for you, and new things coming in 2009. So happy new year, and we'll see you next week. We'll be seeing you again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.